Okay. This is part two between part one and part three of an interview with Winslow Burleson. Today actually is the 27th of January because the interview that we did, part two, I hit the wrong button and erased. My name is Tom Martin. Our location here is at our house in Flagstaff, Arizona. Winslow, could you spell your last name for me, please?
Burleson, B-U-R-L-E-S-O-N.
Thank you very much. Your first name?
Winslow, W-I-N-S-O-O-W.
Great, thank you. If you could pick up the thread from interview one, where you were in high school doing a winter skiing trip, and go from there, that'd be great.
Great. Tom, it's great to be here again and have this chance to record all these memories while they're still fresh. So I was talking about the winter skiing and leading a trip in winter in the High Sierras, in the Tuolumne Meadows, and how I had gotten comfortable with winter and cold and being outdoors and leading trips. And then from there, we talked, I had a number of different outdoor experiences ranging in college from joining the Rice Outdoors Club and being part of a triumvirate. Three Eagle Scouts of us were the leaders of that trip, and we chose to go to the Atchafalaya Bayou in Louisiana, and we had three canoes, and they were out for 4 days and ended up swimming in the bayous and canoeing and through the moss laden trees, and didn't really respect how difficult or dangerous that could be in terms of the snakes and alligators and creatures that are in the water, the garfish in particular, because we were swimming and didn't know enough about the environment at the time. But we had a great trip and survived and came out very lucky. And I mean, that was one water trip. We'd also talked before about my experience on the water with the kayaking and my godfather, who had this West Virginia Scholars Program, and how I learned to do some of the whitewater as a teenager. And so he was training his staff to be whitewater instructors and leaders for their trips for the seniors in high school that he would train for their senior year to go and place into top colleges around the country for the benefit of West Virginia. And he invited me, and I got to learn how to read water. And then I spent a summer on the junior and senior national whitewater races, preparing for them, and then going to them and getting 6 out of 6 in the junior nationals and 29 out of 29 in the senior nationals, getting 163% of Davy Hearn's race time on the exhibition race. But then a couple of months later at the Housatonic races in the fall, I was able to beat one person in a race finally. And then unfortunately, we broke my canoe and didn't get back into it for a while. And so that was earlier. Then we had the college experience with Rice and the outdoors programs, and then came out west to San Francisco and worked as a curriculum developer for the SETI Institute, and continued to do some winter camping up in the Sierras with some friends, getting them into that and, you know, enjoying that some more in telemarketing, and again, in the same areas that I was before, and up against around Tahoe actually as well. But then got into scuba diving and worked my way up through to become an instructor in scuba diving. And my motivation in scuba diving was to learn how to build an underwater tent and to essentially do underwater camping. And so I wanted to learn as much as I could about saturation diving and the logistics of putting together expeditions in scuba, and becoming an instructor was a good way to do that. And we also talked in the first section of this recording about my experience learning to swim and how when I did that. And I had learned to swim before I could walk. There was this one home movie in I guess 71 or 2 where they took me up from the pool and I crawled away from the edge of the pool, and they would stand 10, 15 feet apart from each other and push me towards one another, my parents. And I couldn't stay at the surface but I could swim forward. So they'd watch me grimace. And as I grimaced, I mean, they'd watch me be happy for the first, say, 8 to 10 feet. And then as I started to grimace, they would pull me up to the top and I was able to get a little bit of air and they'd turn me around and celebrate and push me back to the net, to the other, and back and forth. So I was this little torpedo going back and forth between my parents. So, you know, completely comfortable in water, ranging from before I could walk all the way up through instructor scuba diving. And we're actually currently working on a patent for this underwater tent through NYU. And so it's exciting to sort of see things move forward and come to culmination, which is also part of the motivation for doing these other kinds of experiences, like becoming conversant in sailing. And I just bought a sailboat for deep water, blue water exploration to maybe do a longer trip to Bermuda or up to Greenland or something in a couple of years. Be able to, you know, think about all the safety and the logistics and all the things that you need and how to be self-sufficient and reliant and have backup structure and who's going to be on your trip and, what skills you're going to have, and all the different systems, you know, sewing and repairing a boat on a river, sewing a sail, you know, building a fire pan. We have pictures of the fire pan that I innovated out of, turkey baster roasting pans and they had questioned that at the ramp and said, well, I don't remember what we decided here. Let's find out from the supervisor. And the supervisor was off on Sunday. And so I pointed out that it was metal, that it was large enough, and that it was actually structurally built. It had the leg structure. It was manufactured, and it was made out of metal, and it would be on top of a fire blanket. So all of those things are coming together. But, you know, this motivation of ranging from, can I do this thing? Do I have the skills? Do I have the knowledge? To, as I do it, I want to learn about alternatives. You know, thinking about a trip in the canyon, one of the things we thought about was, is there a way to circumvent every rapid? If you didn't know how to read the water, could you run or pull things down the side and just enjoy the you know, 20, 30 days that you might have on the river? Started calling around and getting some feedback on that. And, I'm getting out of sequence a bit here, but you know, the scuba diving and the instruction, and then the swimming. I also had a brief experience in a dry suit in scuba diving. So then I went to grad school and did product design at Stanford in mechanical engineering and human computer interaction in affective computing at the MIT Media Lab. And the Media Lab had MIT had a sailboat where we could learn how to sail and become very good at that. And so I got to learn a lot about the teamwork and logistics and sailing. And so from there, after graduating from the Media Lab, I got a job at Arizona State University and came out here and came up to the canyon a whole lot of times and did some, I'd read a New York Times article about individuals taking off from Lee's Ferry, going up to Glen Canyon Dam, and that there was a shuttle that you could sign up and you'd get your boats towed up there and have those boats, and you could come back down from the shuttle. And it was only 6 hours, but you get this entire wonderful experience of the canyon minus the rapids. So I had a canoe that I brought out from some kayak water polo that I was playing at MIT. And so I had the hard shell canoe and I set into the water at 4 p.m. on, you know, a Friday and started paddling upriver to Glen Canyon Dam. And coming over the bridge at Navajo Bridge, I looked down and I was like, wow, one, it's huge. And two, there's a lot of ripples and turbulence that you see in the water. There's no white water per se, but you can see things happening that you're not sure if you haven't been on the water for a little while that you know, how that's going to affect you. And then I went into the gift store and I saw the Death and Destruction in the Canyon book and a number of other, you know, Danger in the High Country and things like this. And I wasn't quite sure. So I finally got on the water at 4 p.m. with maybe 3 or 4 2-liter soda bottle waters. And I shoved my tent and sleeping bag into my shell and got everything in the boat and paddled. And I started hearing these beaver slapping on the, but I thought they were large fish because it was so dark. I hadn't seen the beaver and finally pulled over and went to sleep. In the morning, I saw the beavers swimming around and slapping, and went for a hike. And then I paddled all the next day up past some fly fishermen and camp, a number of people camping up there. But I knew I was only 6 miles away at any time, so I could always float down, and I had a sense of safety. And you know, sort of the grandeur of the engineering phenomena of the Glen Canyon Dam when you turn the corner and you see it, and okay, well, now I've got 6 hours downstream and take it leisurely, stop for some hikes, and get back to ASU and work and other things. So that was the first solo water trip. And that was, I don't remember the exact year, but it was maybe 2011 or 12. And then I got a job at NYU and moved in 2014 to...
So NYU is...
New York University.
Thank you.
And I joined NYU in the fall of 2014, in September, and was sort of exploring, you know, a whole new place, and feeling that I hadn't gotten up to the canyon enough, and had always wanted to, you know, experience again the canyon proper, the downstream from Lee's Ferry. And I had experienced that in '89 with my family on a commercial trip in which I had gone as, you know, I guess I was 17, 18, and had some experience on paddle rafts with a guide, and then a couple rapids with Ducky, very light rapids, and the magic of the lower, the LCR, lower Colorado River, and remember diving and jumping off high peaks and into the water and up the side canyons and coming around and having kind of a spiritual experience in terms of seeing a sunrise one morning and feeling the sort of the holistic nature of nature and solitude. And I'd walked a little way away from camp and experienced this. And you know, just took a moment there as a teenager, late teenager, to sort of appreciate how amazing and magical the space was and the time was. And another experience on that trip was one of the guides, they felt that maybe some of the younger participants on the trip weren't getting everything they wanted out of that, or, you know, they could out of this experience, and weren't reflecting enough. And so one of the guides pulled a couple of the younger participants aside and said, just sit here for a moment and just remember this moment and this place and this space and as much as you possibly can throughout your life. And so that was another, you know, moment of reflection and peace. And so in the fall of 2014 at NYU, started looking into the canyon and started looking into the lottery system and signed up. And my girlfriend Cree encouraged me to do that. And then I learned about the difficulty of the lottery and the that essentially there's like a 1% chance most of the year of getting, there's this graph that shows that every date other than December 15th through January 15th has essentially a 1% chance of winning. Whereas there's a 10% chance in the dates between those dates. And so I chose January 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th weekdays in early January that would allow me optimal chances to get a chance to go. And then a couple weeks later, maybe, got the email saying you won the lottery. And so I was like, okay, great. I'm going to go on January 4th, 2016, and almost a year from now. What does this mean? How do I do it? Who am I going with? I got a permit for a 16-person trip. I mean, I just chose whatever was available on those days. And so I get a permit. It allows me to have anywhere between 1 and 16 people and go up to 25 days and within the canyon proper, and then extended days beyond that. And so I needed to figure out what I was going to do. I got in touch with the Boaters Association, Grand Canyon Boaters Association, and emailed some of the officers and got recommended to call you, Tom, and had a good conversation. Tom was, you were super enthusiastic and said, well, you know, if you're a good swimmer, you wear a life jacket, you've got a dry suit, you're willing to swim and comfortable in water. It's going to be cold and it's going to be rainy. You know, you want to spend and enjoy the time there. You might want to 14 or 16 foot raft, and you might want a big tent that you can hang out and enjoy even when it's cold and wet. But you can do it. You can do it together, you and Cree, or you can go solo, or any number of configurations. But the best thing you could do is to get on a trip between now and then, either on another river or on the Grand Canyon River. And here's the Facebook page where you can look for boaters who need people for their trips. And so I did that and met up with Mike Connolly, who was leading a trip in August of 2015. And he put together a trip with eight people on it and three boats, 18-foot rafts from Moencopie. And it was a hybrid Moencopie rental, so they had one of their own boats and some of their own food and equipment, and then some of Moencopie's food and equipment. And there were some logistical issues about who was providing what.
So I'm going to jump back in here for a minute, Wynn, just because I haven't been associated with the Grand Canyon Private Boaters Association for over a decade, and we're not on speaking terms. So I'm trying to figure out.
I'm not as familiar. I would say several things.
Was one, it the Rafting Grand Canyon Facebook page? Is that how we connected? So I'm trying to figure out how that worked.
There were three people, I think you and two others of some association, that had emails or phone numbers listed.
That would be Joe Johnson, and that would be Tom right. Roby.
Sure. Well, Joe
Johnson, she's...
Yeah, so I connected first with Joe, and then you were on email. And which organization is that going to be?
That's River Runners for Wilderness.
So I was looking into, which is also part related, or has some sort of packraft or... related?
No.
Okay. No. So it was River Runners for Wilderness. My approach to this was, internet searches, not a lot of familiarity with the landscape of the organizations or their interests or their nature. You just alluded to that there are a number of different organizations and they have different interests and different complications.
Right. Okay. I just wanted that for clarification. Now we're going to jump back into,
sure.
You met these people, you rented equipment and...
Okay, great. So we, show up and unpack the raft, get picked up at Phoenix by Mike, and 4 hours later and one night in Flag, and end up on the river with a whole crew of people I don't know. And Mike agreed that, if I could read the water from my early whitewater days, that he could teach me to row. And so that was the basis. And if I was willing to have some of the passengers that he was wanting on the trip, then I was going to be able to row my boat and have those passengers. So I had this wonderful experience. I had Jose from Peru, 70-year-old gentleman who had been everywhere. And, I was practicing Spanish and rowing and learning how to read the water and hopping on and off the raft and loading and unloading and learning about the strapping and rigging and the oar locks and the cooler and the groover and the paco pads and all of these amazing things that are all configured to lead a very comfortable life and expedition for a group in the Grand Canyon, setting up the kitchen with three to four tables and having all these jobs. And it would take a long time to set up and tear down every day. And we'd say, well, do we need four tables or three tables or two tables? And, can we leave it rigged? And so I learned a tremendous amount and saw the canyon again and learned that I could do this water and that I could enjoy the experience and be competent and confident in my ability to run the river and tying things off, understanding issues of entrapment with a strap that might be too long and what to do about it, or the fact that you need to use your painter line or bow line to tie up and tie off, otherwise you might lose your boat. Very basic, but very important, and that kind of vigilance and consistency that's important both as a captain on a group trip, but then potentially as a solo trip. And one of the guys on our trip had done a solo trip. I forget his last name. Josh was a individual who had done a sea kayak trip through the Grand Canyon, and he had been through a number of times, so I had a lot of chance to ask him about his trip, and he said it was super cold, and he was in the dry suits, and that the kayaks allowed you to cheat some of the bigger water, and putting all that together and understanding that it was possible to do this, I had about a month after that trip to decide what kind of trip I wanted to have. And at work, I had a number of big proposals, and and then I got Bruce Klein's book called Never Boat Alone, asterisks, until you've read this book. And so I read that book in late September and decided at that time that this made sense and I could do a solo trip, and that's the way I would do this trip. And so I moved from coming off that trip with Mike and his crew and Mark and Stacey Egan and Josh and Jose and to leading my solo trip and putting, I think one of the first things I did think about was food. And I had this sort of proof of concept, which was that if I wanted to eat 3,000 calories a day, and a can of peanut butter or a small jar of peanut butter has 3,000 calories of peanut butter in it, then I could go with as little as 25 cans of peanut butter. And so that was the size and shape of a peanut butter menu. And, so I knew how much food might weigh or be, or how waterproof it could be. And then from there, I did think about different varieties of food for a while, but, then got much more into the need and, the sort of interesting and desperate need to get all the equipment lined up, to begin to own it, to get the air links, to decide the boat. For a little while, I was considering, building a boat, and I would love to build a boat in the future. And I think with a sailing, there's another interest, which is, can you fly somewhere with your boat and then put it in the water and live on it? That can either be in whitewater conditions or not. And so, this is, this whole trip in some real respect is a heavy version of being able to do that. And that's a piece of it. Reading his Bruce Klein's book, you get into the reflection. There were two or three other seminal resources at that time, which were the videos online from one of the groups does a self-support kayak video, and they were doing a lot of description of what the equipment was and how to do it and what the groover tube looks like. And there's another couple resources out there on how to build the poop tubes. And most of the trips in this space go for short times, 9, 10, 11, 12 days. And so there was this added logistics of my calculation where I started seeing that my weights were going to potentially be well above the difference between, say, the payload of the Air Lynx 1, which was 350 pounds, and I weighed 225. So 125 of everything for 25 days. So I was getting into 175, and I'm calling the company saying, well, what does your payload mean? And they're saying, oh, it's 1/3 of the waterline of the buoyancy of the boat. And you're saying, well, okay, well, maybe you go half. Maybe, and so anyway, they have the Air Lynx 2, which is a 400 payload, or 450. So you get an extra 100 pounds of leeway. And I didn't ever weigh the total amount, but I think it was up closer to 400 at that outset, between me at 225 and all the equipment. And then Tom had the great suggestion of trying out all your equipment before you fly to Arizona. And so I got my boat in mid-December, and I got my dry suit in mid-December, and hopped in them and hopped out on the water. I played kayak water polo during the summer and fall, and had been in the canyon in the summer. But so I had a lot of good water experience in the past year, but not in the winter, and not with the boat, and not with the dry suit. So got all that together, learned that the Air Lynx is inflatable and needs slightly longer paddles, for example. And so I had got these Warner white water paddles, but then realized that I needed a different paddle for the boat that I had. And so you learn these things as you practice them and get there, and how everything's going to come together and be put together. And so I came out and with all three checked bags and two carry-ons, and ended up spending an intense day and a half, both finishing a grant and buying $400 or $500 worth of food, paddles, extra paddle. I had my life jackets. All the logistics and huge amount of packing, just getting everything in and understanding that the stoves were going to work and testing my stoves and realizing that they were too old and hadn't been used in a while and needed to buy a stove. So go and buy a stove. Getting out here and then packing it all up, seeing if it's all going to fit, and then getting up to Lee's Ferry and showing the ranger the fire pan and building the fire pan. I hadn't put the fire pan all together until the last night, so I knew I could do it and I knew what it was going to look like and that the parts were there. But that night I had my tin snips and my screws and washers and put it all together. This whole process unfolding until you're finally ready. You, Tom, were great, both at the shuttles and spending the night and helping me rig and understanding. And also we had this wonderful experience. We went over and saw the stagecoach, trails from 1820s or
1870s.
Yeah. And the insignia from the division that had gone through there and then the petrified wood. And this is right across from Lee's Ferry up, in the, Native American land there. And we rolled the kayak a couple times and swam with Tom giving some suggestions and just ensuring that, that I was able to do all that with all the load, and it worked very well. And then slept and got on the water. Did my inaugural swim every day in the 89 commercial trip. A number of people would swim right at the beginning. And then in the summer in 2015, every morning before getting on the water, I would take a quick dip. And often before running rapids and every time we stop for lunch and everything, I just love the water and I would always just get a dip in there. And so even now with a dry suit, which is a totally different experience because you're still dry after you dip, I did my inaugural dip and I remember coming out of the water and seeing Tom's face, seeing your face, like, no, I don't want a hug. I'll do a high five, but I won't give you a friendly hug send off. Because I was all wet, which made a lot of sense on your part. And got everything strapped on and headed downriver. Saw you at the bridge, or didn't see you at the bridge. I saw somebody at the bridge and they said hello, and I wasn't sure if that was you or somebody else, but I waited a little long. And either I got there before you or after you. And then the second day, it was snowy, and the second day was completely cold and wet and rainy. And I hadn't logistically sorted out all the food yet. So I decided that I needed to do that. And I had, so I read all the park regs again. I read to understand now that I'm on the river, where can I stop? Where can't I stop? What are the safety? What are the precautions? What are the water filtration? When am I going to filter the water versus using the chemistry and chemicals? All of those, just to remind myself, right in situ on day two. And even before going on any of the bigger rapids, wanting to make sure everything was rigged down. And so that day, I spent going through my fanny pack and the safety and the logistics of what's going to be in the fanny pack, how many jars of peanut butter or six. So different people travel with six Cliff bars, and I replaced three of them with the jar of peanut butter, which is higher calories. Had the water and the fire making and the GPS spot. I use an ACR Link Quest or Rescue Quest, Rescue Link, something like that, that was just another alternative. And testing that, I had tested it before, but just tested it one more time. And then just making sure everything was in its right place and ensuring especially food, because I just bought all the food, but I didn't know how long it would last or how much I should be eating each day. I knew I had plenty of calories, but I didn't know how, so I wanted to sort that out. And I did a pretty good job of sorting that out, and then get back on the water, hit a number of the big rapids, increased the capacity to do more and more rapids. I think the third day or second or third day, I swam for the first time in the water. And what was happening was my boat was heavy enough with all the stuff that I would go through the beginning well and hit my line. And then the waves and water would start filling into the boat, even itself bailing. But and so I was fine on that level. But at that point, I would maybe get caught by an eddy line or a trailing wave in a rapid. And so it wasn't early in the rapids, but later in the rapids, I was, and I think the biggest contributing factor was that I had a lot of heavy stuff fairly high. So that and my early stages of the of being on the water, I would just sort of flip over, and then I would exchange my knee strap for my hand. So I'd be right there with the boat, and I always remembered and learned to hold my paddle from my earlier whitewater days. And so I would ride out one or two more waves, grab these wonderful little straps. We'd done a flip strap, but I found that it was... you know, trailing in the water, providing drag and friction. And also, I felt that the handles were working well enough that I wasn't using the flip strap. So I just took the flip strap off and just used the handles because the kayak itself has these two nice flip handles built into the bottom of it. And so I would use the flip handles and then heave myself back up in and get back in. One of the really nice things about the boat is that it was... big enough that you could relax. You could, I mean, just big enough, you know. So unlike a hard shell, you could, you know, lie down a little bit, you know, you putting your legs on either side of your gear in front of you, but at least not be in a hard shell where you might not feel your legs for days and days at a time. You could put both your legs on one side and you could lie perpendicular to the guy, to the boat. You know, there was enough sort of leisurely. So I remember one time I was getting really tired at the end of the day and I sort of lied down and I was kind of almost drifting off to sleep while I was on the water. I was like, this doesn't seem very good. You got to sit up and pay attention. You know, so I mean, it was in the lulls between rapids, but, you know, if you fall asleep, you might not still be in the lulls between rapids. And so, but the boat was very comfortable in that respect. And, you know, making all these discoveries all the time, things like that. At first you're experiencing the total magic and wonder of the cliffs and the river and the eddies and the vibrance of the water that you're challenged by. And then some of the great sort of big highlights of the trip were in the rapids and in crystal and granite and understanding just how big these waves were and how small I was, where this whole thing is 5 to 10 times bigger than you are in just the pocket of that wave, right? So, you know, but you're still coming up over the wave and staying upright and hitting your lines and able to do it. And it's just this amazing... completely involved flow type experience where you are in that. And I think in the summer trip in 2015, I had hit every line or done every rapid without flipping the raft. We had an 18-foot raft, but had ended up going through lava and it's fine. I ended up going through lava and getting swept out of the boat. So I hadn't had enough sort of footholds or other things set, and this was the first sort of wave that completely came up on to the boat, and I got pulled out, and Josh turned around, and he was like, are we going to hit cheese grate? You're not there. And I had hung on to the line, and Josh pulled me back in and managed the rest of that rapid. But so I had this opportunity in lava where this winter... I was able to try it again. And so I pulled over, scouted, and I think, you know, lava is one of the later rapids and there's so much sort of mythology and buildup to it that it has its own kind of psychic tension, even though I tried to minimize that. You know, you're unlike many of the scouts where you're right there at the side of the river and feeling the water, you're up above. You don't experience the water in exactly the same way. You're seeing the magnitude and the spectrum of what you can and can't do in this water, and not even sure what you how it's going to work out. So I was looking for some of the lines we saw in the summer, the V wave going into the hole and the cheese grater, and you know, I knew the V wave part, but the next one was didn't look the same as the summer, and wasn't clear if it was going to work out. But so I got back down to the boat, did my little dip to, you know, get ready for being wet if that occurred, and followed the bubble line, hit the V wave really well, made it through the next hole miraculously, ended up still buoyant and upright, and hit into the next set of waves, which turned me 180. So now I was still buoyant and upright. I was still quite surprised about that, but I was navigating cheese grater in reverse, and managed to float by that and had a nice pillow cushion. And I was sufficiently to river left that it pushed me off, and got through a couple more trailing waves and realized that I had done it. And I just let out a big scream and said, yeah, this is amazing. It's worked. And so I think some of the tension of appreciating also in lava, you have that whole, you've got lava's anvil, or, you know, and then you've got, or Thor, Vulcan's anvil. And then you have, what Josh had called lava lake before, where you're paddling across the, you know, maybe half an hour or 20 minutes, and depending on how aggressively you're going, you know, this still water, hearing the increasing roar. And so all of that was coming in, and, finally got through that. And so it was pretty amazing. Another concern or experience I had was as I approached Crystal, there was a helicopter in the air and they were flying around. And they were apparently up on a butte or cliff with a potential rock climber, or I don't know what they were doing, but they, you know, as I approached, they weren't interested in me and weren't telling me not to run the river. And so I was scouting, but this chopper was overhead. And so that created an interesting tension. So we talked about the best things in the first interview and the bad things. I think the best thing was the boat and the logistics and all the amazing teamwork, both from all the different trips that I've been on and people that were going to give me, like yourself, so much advice and so much generosity to make this possible. The amazing magnitude of the canyon, and I'd been doing a lot of meditation and mindfulness, both on the summer trip, and had a chance to get back into that in that amazing space in the canyon during my winter trip. You know, the solo aspect is that, you know, I didn't see people for 12, 15, well, yeah, it's 12 days or 10, 12 days at, for the latter part, which was wonderful and amazing. Just this space of being alone and the air traffic quieted down. Then in the middle of the trip, you have the sort of luxury of Phantom Ranch, and I had two great meals there, dinner and social time and breakfast, met a bunch of people. A number of people took great pictures of me and showed me. That's another thing on a solo trip. It's very hard to get pictures of yourself. You get a bunch of selfies, but not really in the rapids or on the water or all suited up. And so I got a couple of pictures from people at the river there. And Stacey Egan made this amazing watercolor picture. And I drew a watercolor on my first day that was nowhere near as good, but was similar. It was the same topic. It was the boat and rigging and the canyon, and it was interesting. So I think just want to thank everybody for everything that contributed to making this an amazing trip and bringing it all together.
Cool. Very, very cool. So this is the end of part two of a three-part interview. Again, part two was conducted after part three, unfortunately we pressed the wrong button and lost part two.
Yeah.
And so we've redone it again. Today is the 27th of January, 2016, and this has been a Grand Canyon Historical Society oral interview with Winslow Burleson. Thanks so much, Winslow.
Thank you, Tom.